Welcome to the Education Pre-Hospital Care Research Forum Journal Club. Here in our PCRF Journal Club, we promote evidence-based practices by critically evaluating the latest science in emergency medical services. We hope our discussion will help advance EMS practice. Through the generous support of our sponsor, Limmer Education, we can make science more accessible and understandable. Well, hello, and welcome to the December 2024 Pre-Hospital Care Research Forum Education Research Journal Club. The PCRF promotes research literacy to advance the science of EMS educational research. Now, here with the PCRF Journal Club, we're going to take a closer look at some of the latest research in medical education. Thank you to Limmer Education for sponsoring these podcasts so we can bring you the best of science in education. I'm Megan Corey. I am here with a full crowd today. We've got David Page, we've got Michael Caduce, we have Alex Tremblay, Dr. Kim McKenna, and Dr. Bill Toon. And today we bring you our annual, drumroll please, the best of education research in 2024. So thank you all for joining us today. You can use the chat feature, by the way, not on your screen, not just to type in questions and comments, but maybe you have some of your favorite research of 2024 that's related to education, and we can bring those into the conversation. We can monitor our chat and check that out. Now, let's look. We have done a lot this year. David Page, I want to bring you on. We've done a lot this year. This is just our journal club, education journal club list that, from this year. So we started with, you know, meditation. Remember that program in meditation, mental health. We looked at a lot of different ways of teaching skills. We talked about things that you can really, you know, sink your teeth into the classroom. And then we ended the quarter, the last quarter, with AI and Smart Sim with Aaron Donathan. Just a really great year. So, David, I would like you to tell us more, too, about what's been going on with PCRF this year and where we're headed.
So this is a banner year, truly. We've never seen a year like this. So for naysayers that think that EMS is not based on evidence or not moving towards evidence-based practices, or that we don't use science to advance EMS and EMS education in particular, I think that's just, you know, more and more untrue. I think that we are seeing tremendous energy and effort into doing the research in emergency medical services. So that's awesome. At EMS World Expo, we host the International Scientific Symposium, and we had 82 abstracts this year, which is the most we've ever had by a landslide. We in banner years had 50 abstracts submitted. 82 is like it was a record. That means more research, but is it quality research, right? So, you know, so what? We've got, you know, Doritos, just eat some and crunch some more. Is that really any good? But it was very nutritious and very auspicious and prospicious and wonderful to see the quality of the research just skyrocket. I think that our partners at ESO linking the outcomes of the patients have made those workshops amazing. There's one coming up in May 7th through 9th. So it's still, signups are still open at the prehospitalcare.org website, which we can definitely put up on the in the chat, but they're only open for a few more days for that particular workshop. We are on pace for 2025 to have perhaps more than even 6 or 7 workshops. Our workshop in Wisconsin with Weinman and Medical College of Wisconsin, focused on ventilation and airway, is full, and so the response from the community in terms of participating has been amazing. We did a workshop with NEMSIS on post-crash care and trauma just this last December. And then we will see, in addition to that, Two more workshops with NEMSIS next year. We're hoping one on the East Coast. And our CareStar equity focused workshops have been amazing. We had one this last year, and two of those, I guess one project is going to be an oral at NAMSP. Another one from the ventilation workshop we did in Utah is going to be an oral presentation at NAMSP coming up here next week or the week after next in at NAMSP in San Diego. So these are great opportunities for someone who is not necessarily an expert in research to just show up with an idea and leave with an abstract. And we're connecting our data partners and statisticians, epidemiologists, to help those teams come up with a project that has meaning, that has impact, eventually leading to a paper and publication. And that's the project, Megan, that you just mentioned with simulation and virtual reality was actually born that way. Mm-hmm. And so we're incredibly thankful to really be hopefully a part of, if not at the center of, more EMS providers understanding their role, not only in reading and interpreting research, but participating in the process of generating new science. And we have mentors standing by. So if you have a project and you want to do it, please tell us. But please visit our website. I saw that Michael Caduce put it on the chat. And stay tuned for workshops in April in the Bay Area for equity. But for sure, we'll have a fall ESO. We're talking to NEMSIS just to nail down the dates for those as well. And you know, Austin in May is really kind of cool. So please just jump in and help us out and be a part of the change, be a part of the
yes.
process. And thank you to all our data partners. Image Trend has been amazing as well. So I don't want to leave anybody out. And of course, our sponsor here, Limmer, who has been wonderful at yes. being able to get all this out and making science mm-hmm. accessible, understandable. So it takes a village, right?
It's absolutely. I just wanted to say, encourage your students, if you're an educator out there, encouraging students to participate and submit their questions, apply for one of the workshops. We've had students
one
get
of
accepted.
Your students yes. has an oral in San Diego.
Yes.
It's still just in paramedic school, and it mm-hmm. ranked among 300 or plus projects. It ranks in the top 10, and they're going to present it in a room full of EMS physicians.
It's exciting. It's very exciting.
You know, my yeah. and M sir.
Yep.
They're just rock stars, and they rocked it with their homeless inequities with stroke. You know, it's not yeah. educational research, so we're not going to talk about it today, but you know, amazing
trying to get more into educational
with
research
mentoring as well. So
yeah,
anyway,
great stuff. All right, so now we're going to take a walk through a few articles. Each one of us has picked an article to share, and we put them in the order following from the classroom all the way to completion. So I'm the first one up, and my pick is one that we actually did. So I'm the only one here, I think, that picked one that we actually have already done. So I'll spend just a couple of minutes on it and we can move on to the next. But I will tell you, you can subscribe to our YouTube channel, remember, or you can go to it and see this episode. This was the Mike and Kim and I presented this live at the NEMC Symposium in Pittsburgh. We had two special guests that was kind of at the last minute that we had them come in, and it turned into this amazing conversation. Sahej Khalsa, who was the one who picked this article and sent it to us, and then he joined us. And then Dr. Heather Davis, who is an expert on teaching and learning, especially in the area of student assessment, came in and really provided some extra depth to the this theory-based intervention that took place in this study. So this study, Growth Mindset Messages from Instructors Improve Academic Performance Among First-Generation College Students, this was produced out of Washington State University. Elizabeth Canning and colleagues here have done research on growth mindset messages. And so some of their prior research is great. This is in an open access journal, chemistry, biological, engineering, something like that, life sciences education. It was published in the summer of 2024. You can look it up. It was about overcoming barriers for non-traditional, specifically first-generation college students, through instructor-initiated messages. So it was an experimental study. It examined whether growth mindset versus control instructor messages by email improve performance in an introductory biology course, a really important place to study this because that's a gatekeeper course. Think about your gatekeeper courses, the ones that can really throw up barriers if a student can't move beyond them. And intro biology courses are gatekeepers to STEM careers, to medical careers, to all kinds of things. So, and that we already knew the problem, first generation college students, non-traditional students, fare worse than their counterparts in these gatekeeper courses. So they had 417 undergraduates that were randomly assigned at the student level to account for, to control for instructor variability, section variability. And then at key points, they were randomly assigned, first of all, to a control versus the intervention group. And at key points after major exams, they would provide messaging, and the messaging in the control and in the intervention had sort of an introduction email that gave the mean and median exam score, how the grades were calculated, and that the instructor would happy to meet to go over their grade and discuss any kind of feedback that they have about the exam. Then the email that was sent to students in the intervention condition, they received three communication or keys based on the theory of growth mindset, three messages, one on their abilities can be improved, saying things like, you know, I believe every student, regardless of how well they did, can improve their skills, case in point, you know, learning's a progress, let me give you some secrets, and telling them, that they can definitely improve their performance with some evidence that prior students have done this. Academic struggles are normal to experience is the other basis for this message. And then the third thing was academic struggles are the result of controllable rather than uncontrollable factors. So providing some effective evidence-based learning strategies to help them improve specific things like, studying every day after class instead of cramming with a group, creating concept maps, identifying information gaps, instead of rewriting lecture notes or highlighting. And then they caution against the false growth mindset, things like, oh, you just need to try harder, or you can do anything you set your mind to. I thought it was they made some just excellent theory, grounded in the theory of growth mindset points in this. And those messages went to these students. And what they found was, the other thing I will say, and Michael and I did this session together, so Mike, you can support me on this one. They provided supplemental materials where you could pick up these. They provided the actual emails that they sent verbatim. So you could pick these up. You can, change them to your classroom and you can try it. So I really love when an author does that. So you could take it, you could continue the research, or you could just do kind of an intervention and see, what kind of results you might get with students that maybe struggle on tests. So when the instructor communicated these growth mindset messages at key points, the results were the students earned higher grades in the course as compared to the control. And the most pronounced was for the first generation college students. Most importantly, it closed the gap. So after they had a higher exam, three score, higher GPA overall in the course, which we know is really key for even incremental changes in a GPA can mean the difference between acceptance into a program. So it was just a really I thought a really important result. And then elimination of the gap is the big thing. So not only did you see the impact on the first generation college students, saw elimination of the gap between the continuing and first generation. So I think the main take home for this, it was that simple, subtle instructor messages matter. And I would encourage you to read this article, pull it. I would love to discuss it with new faculty coming in. We have lots and lots of new educators coming in out of there. This would be a really good one to bring up and start a good discussion. So that's my article. And again, you can go to the YouTube and watch that. So if there's not any comments, the next one up, we're going to go with Michael Caduce and his pick. We're sticking with the classroom, but we're expanding this to simulation-based and interprofessional simulation.
Thanks, Megan. And I really enjoyed reviewing that abstract with you and or that manuscript with you. It was live with Megan and Michael, morning coffee,
morning.
Especially with our two co-hosts. It was quite a bit of fun. And actually, I think that article was so important, even beyond the first generation college students, just something you can easily implement in your classroom, irrelevant of sort of where they land in your class. We have like an orientation binder we give all of our new instructors, and it usually has a couple different research articles in it. And I've started to add this one to it because I think it just so articulately describes a population of students that I don't know that we always think of when we think of students that may be historically underrepresented in college. So it's a great opportunity. So awesome. I am bringing to us an article out of Nurse Education Practice. It was published in November. It's called Building Patient Safety Culture by Using Interprofessional Simulation with Nursing, Paramedic, and Emergency Telecommunications Students. It's a mixed method study, and it's really unique. So they're set up, this actually comes out of Canada, where they actually have a Canadian Interprofessional Health Collaborative, which, by the way, is a whole bunch of other reading that I did that I enjoyed. But what they did was they brought nursing students, EMS students, and telecommunication students or emergency telecommunicator students together, and they ran a simulation with a high-risk OB patient. And so to get everyone involved in the study and in the involvement of it, what they did was they had a simulated situation where a pregnant patient had some community nurses. So the nursing students were actually like in the house assessing the patient, had deemed the patient high risk, and thus they needed to call the telecommunicators to get emergency medical transport, transported the patient to the hospital, and then nurses then took over. So it was really kind of a unique experiment to get everyone understanding the different roles and responsibilities, and to get just involvement from all different aspects of those student populations. A couple of things that I thought were really interesting about the methods, they used a standardized self-reporting instrument, and I did a little bit of reading on this, and I'm going to do more because I didn't know this even existed. It's SPICE-R2. It's Student Perceptions of Interprofessional Clinical Education Revised. It's a standard reporting tool that you can use when you do interprofessional partnership training. Again, I'd never heard of it, but I thought it was really interesting. And then something we have actually talked about on the podcast before is then they also, so they had the students complete that survey after they had them participate in the simulation. And then they used a simulation design scale, SDS, which evaluates sort of the value of the simulation or the sort of the fidelity of the simulation. So they did that. A couple of the key findings, so they all participated in the survey, and this was one cohort of their classes, and I'm trying to think, I highlighted it somewhere in the paper. They had 81 nursing students, 28 paramedic students, and 11 emergency telecommunicators all participate in the study. And then obviously they sampled them afterwards. They have a couple of interesting findings. The telecommunicator students actually had a statistically significant higher score and their understanding of their roles and responsibilities within the interprofessional partnership team, which I thought was interesting. And actually, if we repeated this, probably would be similar. They noted in the study that actually the emergency telecommunicator students are in a different part of the campus, not even with the healthcare students. And they thought that might have had a little bit to do with the understanding roles and responsibilities. And I think sometimes we send our paramedic students to dispatch, or when we onboard students, we send them to a dispatch center to listen to that telecommunicator process. But I don't know that we ever do the opposite, where we send the telecommunicator students to do ride-alongs to understand what it is in the field. So I thought that was kind of interesting. They did a thematic analysis. So part of this was some open-ended answers. Some of the key takeaways that I thought, they said they emphasized the need for accurate and thorough reporting for handovers. That probably equates to every single one of our handovers that we do and that our providers do, is some sort of emphasis on the need for some accuracy and some standardization. They noted the use of distinct communication tools between professions. So sometimes our language and our verbiage gets in the way of the message. They noted that there was some confusion in the responsibilities and the leadership. And I could very much understand that as a paramedic showing up, if there's nurses already on scene taking care of a patient, like who's sort of in charge? So I could see that, and that came through in their test. They also had, let's see, what else did I highlight? They valued, the participants valued prioritizing the patient and family members, which I love seeing in all of our simulation, but love seeing it consistently through the participation here. The need to listen to family and patients came through, prioritizing patient safety, and then communication of near misses, where they had a safety issue that was missed, but someone had actually observed it. And so just that communication. Part of this tool also evaluates for emotional dynamics and professional growth. It was noted that there's some nervousness, scared was the descriptor that they used, and some intimidation with working together, which if you read through all the comments, they note that like they were intimidated and a little bit scared to like deliver their report. But once they did it a little bit, and once they got a little bit used to it, this sort of that went away. So I could see very much where this would have a huge benefit in our classrooms, to sort of demonstrate. So we're all in the same playing field. We're all here for patient safety, and good healthcare. So thought that was really interesting. In terms of metrics and numerics, they demonstrated a whole bunch of different things, but overall, everyone seemed to improve or report that their understanding of interprofessional partnerships and the value that it brought to their education improved. And really, again, was looking for, did they see value in this training? And overwhelmingly, they did. They did, again, a Likert scale. So lots of fours and four and a halves on things like problem solving, guided reflection, fidelity, things like that. So really interesting results, but brought to light, I liked this research because it brought to light a few things that I didn't know, and that there were some standard reporting tools that are out there for interprofessional simulation. Also, this case, just they give you the parameters that they used. Wouldn't be hard to set this up in any program, especially if you've got access to emergency telecommunicator students and nursing students, where you could do this together. But it could similarly be replicated with people who have graduated, so nurses, paramedics, and emergency telecommunicators. So really a fun one.
I have a quick question about this too. So, well, two questions. One is, how can we, and maybe Alex, and you can advise on this one too, because you work in policy. How do we get articles? So this one was not open access. So if I wanted to look at some of the tools that you're talking about, what are some of the ways that I can get this article, you know, if I'm out there saying, well, I don't have access through my library in my community college or...
I think you mentioned this last time or the time before, Megan, where you see the little email or the little message after each of the author's names. You have access, their email addresses are public, so you can email them and ask. I think being an author, you know, all of us are authors, and I think if someone reaches out and says, can we view your manuscript, I think it'd be like, yes, absolutely, I'm glad someone's reading it. I had someone reach out to me just for a recent publication that asked, can we get together and just talk about this? I'm working on my dissertation, is something similar, can we chat? And I was like, someone read my paper? Yes, absolutely. What can I do? You can have all the time in the world. So there's probably some more formal ways to do it, but I appreciated what you said, Megan, which is like, I just cold called the authors.
Yeah, that's my definite go-to method.
So ResearchGate is the other one that I like. Sometimes the authors will post it on their ResearchGate account as a PDF for no cost, but it's another, they have to have one. One of the things that we're going to have to figure out long-term in research is that open access articles are an equity issue. Most open access articles come from large universities that have the money to pay the journal for open access. And it's not inexpensive. I have an article pending, and the original open access cost was $5,000. It's an article I did. I'm not affiliated with a university, at least not full time. I don't have that under a couch anywhere. So I think it's awesome, and I think we should always shoot for open access. I also think that there's a ton of great open access EMS EMS publications, but they all have what they're looking to publish, right? Like SJTREM is not education focused, those types of things. But I do think that long-term open access articles are going to continue to be an equity issue that keeps really good research out of the hands of people that could do something with it.
Yeah, thanks for that. Thank you, Michael, for presenting this. This is a great thing. Did you actually get this from emailing the author? Or did you
No,
have access through?
I have an adjunct appointment, so I was able to log in and just use that to get it. But you're right, it was behind a paywall. Though on this one, it's an Elsevier publication, and I was surprised if you clicked full link text, it was behind a paywall, but they gave you snippets of each one of the sections, and I'd not ever seen that before. So I was a little bit like, oh, I do have the full article now. And then I was like, no, it cuts you off after like two paragraphs. But I thought that was at least interesting that I could see some of the paper. Maybe that was like the hook to get me to pay for it. I don't know.
It was enough to make an informed decision for sure.
Yeah, that's
Yeah,
true.
exactly. And I like that. I do like when they have either the box with the key points or they have enough in there to make, to help you make a decision whether you want to email the article or email the author or what. All right. So next up is Dr. Bill Toon. And Dr. Bill Toon picked this article. Tell us why, Bill. Well, after you unmute
You mean I have to wake up? This is, it's embarrassing when I listen to my other panel members talk instead of just poking at them, and I'm actually going to reverse things here a little bit. What drove me to do this was the call for us to find something that was interesting educational wise. And I want to talk to you about some good and bad things. And the first thing that really caught my eye was they talked about the effectiveness of trauma care and training programs on pre-hospital primary skills, the systematic review. The title sucked me right in, and I says, this will be great. As I've continued to read it over and over several times again, I may have to take that back, but we'll talk about this here a little bit. One of the this is open access, so it's easy for you to get to. I believe we've made, or in our show notes, we'll have everything that's there. Let me go to my copy here. We can just leave this up. All right. So this is a systematic review of a large evaluation of looking at a large, and I'll talk about the sampling method and everything like that, but they wanted to look at the effectiveness of the pre-hospital primary survey. And they speak a lot about the importance of the pre-hospital primary survey. And then they go into talking about how they actually they wanted to look for all kinds of papers on this topic from 2020 onward. So it's not that old of or was it 20 2010. I'll find it here in a second here, and let me go to my notes here that I have. They wanted to conduct this comprehensive systematic review evaluating the impact of trauma and emergency preparedness training. So they search was carried out across multiple electronic databases, PubMed, Cochrane, Embase, Nursing. They wanted to make sure that they found as many relevant topics, studies that they could. They went and again, any kind of search criteria or wording that they could do. They had pre-hospital primary survey, trauma care training, emergency preparedness, anything that they could possibly do. And then they also wanted to look at the modalities: virtual reality, simulation, case-based learning, hands-on workshops. What was the method used to help in the study of all of this material? So the eligibility criteria for this systematic review was defined to ensure the inclusion of high quality studies. And they looked for terms like paramedics, nurses, EMT, advanced medical students, anyone that they could find that was involved in pre-hospital trauma care. So this has got an international flavor to it, because even the authors represent an international influence here. So in some countries, the pre-hospital provider may not be what we traditionally think of as a pre-hospital provider here in the United States. So you'll be able to read through how they decided to abstract all their data, and they use something called a PICO in their process. And I'm not sure how familiar people are with the PICO population intervention comparison group outcome measures, and then results and statistical data. But they use this PICO framework to be able to grab all of this information. So this was the really interesting thing. They initially identified, let's see, I need to find the exact number here that I had. Where's my highlighting? So they yielded about over 200 some odd records. They removed 39 duplicate records. They had 180 unique studies that were screened based upon their titles and abstracts. And out of these, 98 records were excluded due to irrelevance to the review topic. For the remaining 82 reports, they did a full text retrieval was attempted. However, 16 reports they could not obtain. The remaining 66 reports were then assessed for eligibility based upon the predefined criteria, resulting in an exclusion of another 61 reports for reasons such as involving non-healthcare populations, being non-English or published before 2000 was the date, or lacking control groups, measurable outcomes, and ultimately 5. So that's something to take into consideration, is after all of their work, they make their evaluation and everything based on 5 papers. And when you go and look at the 5 papers that they chose that met their criteria and everything, there's only one paper that involves paramedics and in their thing. And that's something, again, you have to look at. In other cases, they have medical students taking ATLS. They have nursing students that are or nursing staff, trauma care. So it didn't end up fitting as much about pre-hospital care that I had wanted to. And their bottom line, so I can open this up for questions and stuff like that, and other things that some of the other people picked up, they looked at this review and they talked about the importance of having a well-designed trauma care and emergency preparedness training program. And they found, they looked at interactive methods like case-based learning, proved more effective for knowledge and retention and skill proficiency than traditional simulation. And they talked about VR showing some potential to supplement as a supplementary tool. It may not be sufficient as a standalone intervention for practical skills. The review also highlighted the need for strategic implementations of programs like MDRNST. I'll have to go back and find out what that definition is. So it seemed very promising to me at the beginning. It got back down to them talking about case-based learning, but that was based upon only 5 studies that came into this. And I'm not sure in my mind, that makes this like, wow, case-based learning is the best and most effective way to do that. Maybe. So I'll be quiet for a minute.
Actually, I'm glad you brought this article to the table, and I think it doesn't need to be the end all be all of systematic reviews. You know, systematic reviews versus scoping reviews. Systematic really looks for the strength of the evidence, so it ranks the papers based on the applicability. The strength of each paper is ranked, and so the evaluators aren't just reaching for anything in the world. And I'm all right with 5 papers making it. It meant that they had a pretty tight criteria potentially. The other, but it does sort of reinforce some of the messages that we've heard repeatedly about case-based learning, about the concept of not the standard just stand up and lecture. And so it makes sense, their conclusions make sense. And even though we did a scoping review that had 5,000 some articles in the initial, kind of first pass, and eventually they ended up being 30 that really, really were focused in on that particular topic. So it isn't out of the ordinary to just kind of cast a wide net and then have really tight criteria to actually narrow it down. And if they had concluded that, I don't know, the earth wasn't round and we should go back to some bizarre thing, I'd say not helpful. But I think just to go back to the Aaron Donathan paper, VR training did increase the confidence levels in EMS providers. So, the hands-on workshops that we do incorporated in every single EMS course known to mankind. That's, to me, all of that is saying we see it. We're seeing other elements that reinforce it. I'm all right with five.
But maybe the thing I should have said, this adds to our body of knowledge.
There you
particularly,
go.
Particularly related to, again, where we look at case-based learning. And I think that's what it does. But I did expect to, it shows there's an opportunity, again, always for more research. And it, in the pre-hospital arena would be ideal, or the out-of-hospital arena. I have no problem with it being providers from other parts of the world, because that, again, gives us nice, lets us know that, yeah, what we're dealing with is the same thing they're dealing with. There's something to be said about that.
Love it.
Alex, I'm wondering if you have any input on, like, what do you look at when you look at systematic reviews? I have a very hard time reading systematic reviews myself.
Yeah, and this is a big honking article, which is good, right? Like, there's a lot to it. Dave's points are well taken, that five is not a bad number. Where it becomes hard is that they started in the 200s, right? So what I look for in terms of a systematic review from a data perspective is how homogeneous they can actually make their result. So in this case, they looked at all of these methodologies, but didn't say like, oh, it's just for paramedics, it's just for nurses, it's for anybody in an allied health profession. We can't continue to think about the way that we train paramedics just as the way that we train paramedics and EMTs. We need to see how other people do the work, right? That was kind of the point of Michael's article as well, is that this interdisciplinary approach is what makes EMS successful. We don't just hand people off and leave. We don't slide them onto the ER cot and go back in service. We have to work together as a group. Where I think that this article falls a little bit short is that the criteria they use to make a homogeneous data set is probably still a little bit loose, right? And so it's a really good article and it's really well put together. I think they probably could have pulled their criteria back and maybe looked at 10 or 15 articles. If you look at the screening tool that they used, they likely could have included more. But then the question is are their conclusions strong enough? And then you do wonder, do they write a conclusion, find the articles that build the conclusion, and then build the screening tool? Or do they actually build the screening tool and say, this is what we actually came up with? And it's hard to tell in this article. Again, I think to Dave's point is well met. Five is probably fine, because this is another step on the long ladder to great research. It just kind of makes you wonder with systematic reviews are really difficult both to execute and interpret.
Yeah, I love the richness of this conversation, because, if you look at like all studies on aspirin, and then you want to add up every study that there was ever done on aspirin and all the patients that were treated by aspirin in various domains, and you kind of go, well, what's the strength of aspirin and the number needed to treat for aspirin? So if you apply this same concept, you look at their PRISMA chart, which is a flow chart that says how did they exclude these things. They off the bat they had like 39 duplicates, and then you start getting rid of non-English articles, which is their their exclusion. So 20 non-healthcare populations, like 21. And then there's a no measurable outcomes. 20 articles had no actual measurable outcomes, which is one of their criteria. So off the bat, you took out like 80 that don't, they're not even going to, and they had trouble retrieving 16, which goes back to the conversation before about you can find something that was referenced somewhere, and then you try and get actual access to the paper, and it's in some journal that either doesn't exist anymore or you can't get it, which is significant. So,
and Dave, I want to
200 down to 100 quick.
Yeah, and I think that's a key thing is how old articles are really can play a role on your ability to get them. I'm having, again, in a separate project of this, it's always interesting when I run across it or the citation that they put in there was incomplete or, you know, just really strange. And I wonder if we, again, are shortchanging ourselves by sticking to English only, because there is, and I'll just give an example. I have found a paper that's written in Russian. The title is very clear. There's been some basic translations done of it, but I'm trying to get the actual original paper so I can get it translated. But it may actually show that there was coronary care, not in Northern Ireland, but earlier in Russia, in Moscow. And I'm trying to find that actual paper to really get some clarity on that. So it's fascinating, but I wonder if we're by not having the ability to translate papers, hopefully in the future that will become less of an issue. You know, we exclude stuff where there may be some really powerful research.
I think with large language models, we're probably there, right? Not going to get great interpretation every time. Anybody that's used Google Translate trying to ask a patient if they have pain has felt that pain. But I think we're close. And I think that that probably even increasingly powers future systematic reviews.
And timeline's important too. I think you're to your point, Bill. I've seen a couple of articles now or a couple of pieces of research where the author has said, to our knowledge, this is the first time this has ever been done. And I'm like, no, it isn't. There was something 5 years before that. So yeah, I think you know, how long do you search too? How far back do you search for when you do your background? I think sometimes people are limiting their searches a little too much and forgetting their seminal articles that occurred a long time ago. That's Bill's new project, finding all these old articles. Thank you very much for presenting this. And we are next going to have Dr. Kim McKenna, who is going to bring us to the EMS Clinical Judgment Theoretical Framework by National Registry and this article evaluating the application of this. So some evidence for the changes that occurred. Thanks, Kim.
Not that anybody's interested in that new exam that came out, but I am conflicted here. I will state my bias here. I am on the board of the National Registry. So that was one of the reasons I probably chose this. Plus, I have a real big interest in assessment and in testing. And so I think everybody knows that, you know, when you're designing an exam of some kind, it needs to have several essential elements. First of all, it has to be secure. Otherwise, all of the other things kind of go out the window. It has to be valid. And that means it should be testing what it intends to test and the measurements used in the appropriate way. And it needs to be reliable, which is basically like it needs to be consistent. So this study was one of several that was used to assess the validity and the reliability of the new clinical judgment model, which added a new dimension to the registry exam at the AEMT and the paramedic levels. And another article in this realm that's very high level statistical evidence that was also published in the journal Pre-Hospital Emergency Care. The first author is Brent Stevenor. And it's called Examining the Reliability and Validity of the ALS Certification Exams with the Inclusion of Clinical Judgment. And that particular study looked at the pilot data that had been done prior to the actual items going live so that they could actually see, you know, in a live environment, how the exam was performing. So this one came before that, and the objective of these researchers was to evaluate the performance of the ability of this simulation to assess clinical reasoning and decision-making in a simulated environment. So what they did was they took 20 EMS crews, so combination BLS, ALS on each crew, and they had them do a videotaped simulated scenario that was based on a 78-year-old patient who had a near syncopal episode and slid to the floor in the bathroom. The dispatch, which I think was an important piece of the information, was for a lift assist. So I loved it, first of all, that they picked this scenario. I thought it was a great one because there's, you know, just so much discussion about this and how we don't do a particularly great job of this in EMS anymore. So they, what they did was they had four EMS physicians and they did a standard setting training for them. So they had some simulated videos and they had to answer four questions. Number one is, did the person determine if the patient was stable or unstable? Number two, are any interventions needed before movement? Number three, how should the patient be transferred from the floor? Number four, does the cause of the fall require hospital evaluation? So they did that training, and then they watched these 20 videos, and they calculated the concordant scores. And they found that the physicians, when they were judging whether they had were successful or not, was high, and all of them were above. They had preset a cut score of 70%. And they found out that there was good concordance between the physicians overall. So their overall sort of gestalt, you know, they first had to say, did they meet this? Yes or no? And then they scored the video using the rubric that was designed by training faculty. And then it was evaluated by some of the psychometricians at the National Registry. And the overall agreement between their gestalt was, and the rubric was very high. So 90.3% for their just sort of overall opinion. Did they answer that correctly? Each of the questions correctly or perform correctly on each of the questions, or their score in the rubric was 91. So it was very close. And but then when they drilled down and they looked at the four individual questions, the agreement was lowest between the physicians when they were when they were looking at question number two. So question number two asked, are there any interventions needed prior to movement? And using their gestalt, only 77.6 of them scored 77.6 versus the rubric, which was 88.5. Sorry about that. So it just, if you look at that question, the appendix, I think, is super interesting here. And if you're teaching in an EMS program or doing con ed, I think it'd be a fun scenario to do with your crews or with your students. So the cues in order to score on this rubric were, did they assess the mental status, check vitals, visually inspect the patient? Did they do a focused physical exam? And their key actions that they had to do to be successful were, did finger stick glucose, 12 lead EKG, recognize that it was safe to move the patient. And then the fourth thing in this area was to reevaluate prior to movement. However, even though there wasn't as high of agreement on question two, the confidence intervals never fell below that 70% benchmark that they had set in the beginning. So they acknowledge a lot of limitations. This was done in one third service EMS agency. It was done by, you know, four medical directors from that area. And they suggest that if they could do a nationally representative sample, it would be better. So basically it's just one piece of evidence to say that this clinical judgment model is valid and assesses what it's supposed to assess on the exam. Obviously, it's not the only piece, but it is just one piece of evidence.
Kim, I have a quick question. Do you think, is this something that we could use, a program directors, medical directors could use in their program for test item analysis? Is there enough of a methodology there or a technique or something that you could use to evaluate your own questions if you try to use these type of questions?
You know, I hadn't thought about that, but I mean, I think it would be a way that you could score simulation, you know, you, a method you could use to score simulations for sure. And then, of course, Rosenberger provided that other article that came out that actually has the framework to construct questions that would be a good way to evaluate your questions, because it really drills down in much more detail about how to actually construct these questions. So I think it could be a great self-evaluation tool as well. And, you know, this doesn't address the actual, like, what are people doing in the field stuff. I mean, the practice analysis was part of the validity evidence, obviously a huge piece of that validity evidence as well.
Do you know, I would be interested. I agree that it would be neat to see this with a national sample. It also would be very interesting to take master educators and have them evaluate the scenario compared to the physicians, you know, because and in fairness, we look at different things. And I'm just wondering how that would work out. And I say master educator, that's a loaded term right there, you know, just an educator, and how they would look at it versus how the physicians. And so this is fascinating. Obviously, as you said, it's one point. There probably will be opportunities, hopefully, if the funding can be found to do this, replicate this, to even add strength to this change that's taking place about using clinical judgment.
I think great point, Bill, and what a great article, Kim. It made me think, just as an educational program, like, do we do any simulations on lift assists or fall prevention, right? We do the AAA and we do the STEMIs and we do the strokes, but you're exactly right. The practice analysis demonstrates that this is a large percentage of calls, and how many of those patients, I was looking at my favorites for a clinical a couple weeks ago, and one of them was, what's the repeat? It was one of the top for NAMSP too. What's the more mortality of a repeat visit? So if they sign a refusal initially, what's the return? And a lot of them were lift assist calls, and like 3% of those patients have a mortality at 48 hours. And you're like, ooh, there's an opportunity for us to be doing, to run a sim like this and show our students what the value is of getting a good detailed assessment and doing all of those things. So even beyond the theoretical framework, gosh, there's an opportunity here just to add some simulation to our classroom.
Yeah, I mean, I think, and if you look at the actual scenario, the patient actually has a second degree heart block type 1. And so recognizing that cardiovascular events can really be a big cause of near syncopal episodes. And when they drill down into the history, they find out the patient has had several of these episodes and so on and so forth. And so the need for, you know, doing a 12 lead, and you think about that, okay, that's only ALS, but lo and behold, you know, in the EMT under their scope of practice can actually acquire and transmit a 12 lead. So they're going to be required to know that that would be a key intervention.
Yeah.
In a situation like this, where the patient has an irregular heartbeat and so on and so forth. And it's good that they made it a little murky in a way, you know, like the patient's blood pressure was, you know, 100 over 70 or something. It wasn't like it was 80 over 50 or whatever. So I love that they used fall, because it does, those calls and the lift assist, first of all, biases a lot of people immediately, particularly if they know the patient and the address.
Yep.
That it's really easy to miss those things. And I think especially novice decision makers can easily, because they might be following the lead of somebody that they've seen when they've done clinical, they can easily fall into the trap of thinking lift assist. So I'm just going to follow that pathway. I just need to lift the patient. Whereas, you know, just the need to think, okay, what could it be? What do I need to think about? What do I need to assess to really get to the heart of the matter and determine, is this a patient that needs more than just help getting back into bed or getting back on the toilet? So, yeah.
Spot on. A great article.
Yeah, this is an excellent article. One of the things for me, and this is a takeaway just in general, every ambulance service I've worked for, there's no such thing as a lift assist. Like, we have clear policies. We are not allowed to just pick somebody up and set them in their chair and leave. It's the same whether you call for chest pain and don't go or whether you fall and don't go. And I think that's a mindset that has been very successful, even in my time as a quality officer for an ambulance service, that I think every agency should adopt. There's no such thing as picking people up and putting them back in their chair anymore.
Yeah. I mean, years ago, I left the fire department in like 2006, and we were having, you know, a busy service and people didn't want to do a full assessment. And I was like, here are the minimum things you must do. But we did change our dispatch protocols and allowed just an engine to go, because we had ALS engines. And so, you know, you can, as long as someone is doing the appropriate assessments, then, and you're recognizing that a minimum of these things need to be done, then, you know, then you're going to hopefully not miss a critical condition for your patient. So, yeah.
I'll just give a comment historically over time. And since I can talk about almost 50 years of EMS now, and it has changed. It is dramatically different now. Alex mentioned policies and procedures. You know, it's true, but when I started, no, they're never even discussed. You just did it. And we did lift a lot of people back, put them in bed and go on our way. No refusal, no nothing. You know, matter of fact, in some cases, no patient contact, you know, because they didn't fit, quote, the criteria of what a patient was. And particularly when I worked for some commercial outfit, if it wasn't billable, they certainly didn't want to know anything about it, you know. So it was it's changed dramatically over time. But what I'm not sure has happened yet, has there been a great transition of knowledge to everyone about this practice change? And I would say that there are still places that don't practice it. I'm just even reading the news happening here in my neck of the woods, it's still a problem. So
Yeah. And the other thing I think to take from this article is that it would be a good exercise to do standard setting for your evaluators before you do practical exams, you know, the way that they did. They had common agreement on what constituted a pass and not a pass. And frankly, I didn't do it in my program. I'm embarrassed to say, but I can remember Terry DeVito, who I knew from NEMC years ago. She always did norming sessions before they did their practical exams to assure that their faculty were all on the same page about what constitutes a pass or not a pass. And, you know, having the rubric, I think, is helpful, at least to be able to make some of those decisions without just having to kind of go with your gut.
Great. Thank you, Kim. I want to ask anybody if they would like, we're going to wrap up here. We only have a couple of minutes here. And if anyone out there would like to see something in the new year, any type of topic or anything, and any of our panelists, if you'd like to see some research on fill in the blank, speak now or email us and let us know. We'd like to, anything in the chat, if anybody's monitoring the chat, that we need to bring in. Oh, you're on mute, Kim.
Langston just relates a former a lift assist on a patient that was critically hypoxic and refusing transfer, and later found out that the patient subsequently died. I mean, I think almost everyone's had that kind of a call where you go back later, and sometimes you're doing all the right things and the patient still has capacity and they still refuse, but...
Yeah. Dr. Maya Dorsett had that podcast, I think, with Ginger Locke on and Medic Mindset on Lift Assist several years ago. Just a really worthwhile, look that one up.
It's
and listen
excellent.
To that. Great.
I just,
listen.
Just listened to it recently, and it's excellent. Yeah. Very, very good.
It's great. Well, thank you to all our panelists, and thank you, and congratulations to all researchers who were able to bring it home in 2024, and we are with you in 2025. Thank you for joining us. We will be back on January 24th, 2025, 10 a.m. Pacific, noon Central. And before that, you can visit with Dr. Emily Crow, Dr. Tony Fernandez. I think Michael and Bill and David are there too on Monday, January 13th with the Clinical Journal Club. So you can join us live each month and you can register at prehospitalcare.org, watch us on social media, and definitely go to the YouTube channel and check out some of the past episodes. And have a wonderful and safe new year, everyone.
We hope you have enjoyed and learned from this PCRF Journal Club. Please share it with other interested EMS professionals. An archive of past Journal Clubs can be found at www.pcrfpodcasts.org. You can also find us on Facebook at PCRF at UCLA and on our website at www.prehospitalcare.org. A special thank you to our sponsor, Limmer Education, providing education tools for success at every stage of your EMS journey.